saying? So, you know, I gyp him and I go on about my way. And so I do some, and I put some up for the next morning to make it the detox. I remember trying to sleep and I'm restless, irritable and discontent, you know, knowing that it's in that drawer. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to it. I don't know if it's going to fall over, if the roaches are going to take it, what, but it's not in my hand. So then I remember a dude downstairs, he still has some money on him. So I'm like, well, I'll just go in his pockets, take his money, do my dope, and then in the morning go to the west side and get what I need.
We'll have a good guest on. Appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with me. What we're going to kind of go through is, you know, getting your kids back in recovery, or just in general, having kids in recovery, what that's like, early recovery, mid recovery. And then, what it's like to deal with the significant other who, you know, I don't know yet. We'll get to it, but who may or may not be identified as an alcoholic, but trying the California sober way while you try to maintain what your program and work a solid program, some leadership roles, the death of friends in recovery. I mean, unfortunately, that's a thing that happens. We'll talk about that and then we'll go from there. So, why don't you start off with your sober date?
Yeah, I got a clean date. It's May 28th of 2020.
Perfect. So you're one of those people that I always wonder, how the fuck did they do it during COVID? I hate to beat the COVID drum, but I always wondered. I mean, that was 3 months after COVID lockdown occurred. And I always wonder how, I didn't know how people would stay clean or sober without being able to go into rooms. Let's talk about that real quick. How'd that work out?
I mean, I think I've been doing this for a long time. You know, I've been in the room since I was 13 years old. So I pretty much kept banging my head different types of ways. And I mean, I was beaten this time. I was truly beaten. I always talk about in my lead, I had a spiritual bottom. And, and that, I think that one trumps all the other bottoms.
Okay. So before you had got this time, how many times had you tried it before?
10, 15 times. Like, really? I mean, just astronomical numbers.
What, so when by tried, do you mean that you actually came into the rooms, got a little bit connected and then relapsed, or just, you just, tried to get clean and couldn't?
At first, I was forced into it the first couple times or whatnot. And I would say about the last three or four times, like I was trying, and then I just wouldn't do everything that was suggested to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hear, you know, for anybody listening, like the simple suggestions, like 90 meetings in 90 days, go to, you know, get a sponsor, work steps, be of service. I mean, those are the, if you follow that simple way, it usually works out.
Yeah, that's, it's funny to me. You know, people now, times has changed and the whole AA is changing, which is good. Everything's about change, I think. But for me personally, and when I do work with another alcoholic, I tell them the 90 and 90, you know, because that's what I was brought up on.
Yeah. But so you lived for probably a year or so on just virtual?
Yeah, my sponsor, though.
There's still some rogue ass AA meetings.
Yeah, there were some. And then my sponsor would have AA meetings at his house. So there would be like a group of like eight or nine of us. We would go over there and do meetings.
Oh, that's the fucking best, isn't it? I mean, it's intimate. You're able to be a little different. It's way different. House meetings are probably how they started.
Yeah.
To talk about a little bit, just a kind of little summary on what your childhood was like.
You know, I got taken away from my family at a very young age. I was 11 months old. Me and my sister, she's younger than me. She was just born. She was a preemie. And we got put into foster care.
Why was that?
Mom and dad, I don't even think they was together at the time, but Children's Services found me. Someone called Children's Services, and I was malnourished, had, you know, burns on my skin and stuff like that. And, you know, she smoked crack and drank. So it was just a bad situation.
So how long did that last? Did you ever get back with your original parents?
No, I never reunited with them to a sense. I mean, I met them as a grown-up, but I stayed in that same foster home. I didn't have to bounce around. You know, I went there, and then a couple of years later, I got adopted by that family. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I have several friends that have been through that process, and it's great that kids are in there that are young. This is from experience, from hearing other people talk about it. I know a lot of men that have been adopted, but you know, I have a friend that was older when he went into the system, and he kept fucking getting thrown back and forth. Like, they would just send him back when they were done, you know, and then another family would get him and they would send him back when they were done. So it's kind of fortunate that you were so young, you know, because parents and you know, now as being a parent, it's different, you know, having a small baby versus adopting like a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
So, how were they?
You know, now looking back on it, the more I get sober, like, I'm more level-headed about the whole situation, and I see the good in it. You know, at that age, I didn't see it. Me and my dad, like, I hated him. You know, we would physically fight all the time and stuff.
The foster dad?
Yeah. He was real abusive, mentally and physically. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mom, she just didn't have... She wasn't able to speak up for herself and stuff. And I remember she would always tell me, like, you gotta stop making him mad. That's why he's not, you know what I mean? I just didn't understand that. And, so I would hate him mostly. And then, but he died, he killed himself. I think I was 11, and you know, that was traumatic. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't know it at the time. Like, I was crying and stuff, and I'm mad that I'm crying, not understand why I'm crying. And then, working the steps, I realized that, you know, that was the only father that I knew. That's the only man that was in my life. And at the end of the day, I loved him, mm-hmm. you know. And
despite the abuse.
Yeah, despite it. And, you know, coming up in the 90s and stuff, like, you know, people hit their kids a lot more than what you see nowadays. Like, nowadays you go to jail. Like, you no see shit. People going to jail. I'm like, damn, like, we got beat on the regular. It didn't mm-hmm. matter, you know. And then mom got into a new relationship real quick after he died. And so, I mean, the whole situation was weird, but then me and that guy didn't get along for the longest. And but like I said, AA kind of helped me with the whole thing. And like now when I see the stepdad and the adopted mom, like I love them. And, you know, I give them hugs and I treat them with respect. And they treat me with respect, you know. Cause they see what I'm doing now and stuff. Cause even then at that age, I was wild, lying, cheating, and stealing and stuff. So it goes both ways.
When do you think, if you could remember back when your first use was?
Oh, it was shortly after he died. I was 11 years old.
What was it? What was it?
I always tell people, I tell this when I leave, cause I got sent to Stevens House of Hope. It's a adolescent treatment center when I was 13. And I was in this group setting, you know, everybody's telling their little war stories and stuff. And one dude's talking about 151, and I knew what that was. So for the longest, I'd tell everybody, like, yeah, my first drink was 151.
Just because it sounded cool.
Yeah, you can light it on fire and stuff. And but the first drink was Zima. And, you know, there's nothing cool about that.
No, there's not. Manly.
blacked out on it and everything. Yeah.
Your first time?
Mm-hmm.
God damn. So throughout your childhood, you just, continued using after that first time, or was that?
I set it off right then and there. Like, I didn't stop, did not stop that, you know, that mental allergy and, all that stuff. It just took off full flight.
Yeah. I've heard so many child stories where they use young like that, but then it goes a while just because of access and everything else. But then there are some people that, you know, they start like that and never stop. How about when you first received your first set of consequences as a result of using?
So I was about 13. I didn't have no alcohol, no weed. I was just walking through the school and I was just bored. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go break into a house, you know, because that's the kind of ideas that I get. And, I just left school, went and broke into a house and brought it back to school. Everything that I stole, I brought it back. Happened to be the captain of the basketball team's house that I hit. And
what are the odds of that?
Yeah. And, you know, my ego's like, yeah, I got all this stuff. I stole this. Da, 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 da. Just snitching on myself, you know, and everybody. I tell everybody. So, I mean, they came that period, teachers and a group of students and stuff. And I had this elaborate story where I got it and they weren't believing it. And I just rushed out of there real quick. And, they chased me. And by the time I got outside, there was helicopters, a chopper, all types of stuff. I was like, oh, this is for real.
So what happened as a result of that?
Went to jail and started that whole probation thing. I was on probation my whole adolescent life. You know, from the time I was 13 to 18, I was on some type of probation, house arrest, ankle monitor, all of it.
You said back in the 90s. So did you go to a regular just juvenile jail, or did you go to TECO or anything like that?
I went to juvenile. Yeah.
I remember growing up, because I grew up in the 90s, hearing about TECO. So I just wondered.
I always heard about, I had a foster brother. He was in a lot of trouble. They always would send him to, they would call it Hannah Neal or something like that. And he would always go there, and he would tell us stories like how so bad and stuff.
Yeah, because you imagine, you go in there as a 12-year-old small, and there's a fucking 17-year-old almost grown man in there. You'd be fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how long, did you stay at home? When did you end up leaving your house?
I was always in and out. Like, I would get kicked out, and then I would leave, and then mom would come find me and stuff, and she would pretty much make me come back because I was an adolescent, so I really didn't have no choice. But I left the nest when I was about 16. Then I think I came back for a little bit, and then once I turned 18, I was gone. She kicked me out for good that time.
And then, so how in terms of your using, kind of talk me through that progression.
So, when I was adolescent, it was just drinking and smoking weed. And, I would dabble with stuff, whether it was X, Red Rock Opium, mushrooms, coke. I would do everything. Special K, mm-hmm. All that. And, but I never really, stuck with any of it. It was just weed and alcohol. And I was, doing the whole gas station run out with the beer, running people's garages that have refrigerators in there, steal the beer, steal liquor out the houses, whatever. And I was drinking every day. First thing in the morning. Once I turned 18 and I got kicked out, it got really bad. I was drinking a lot more and trying to count surf and stuff like that. And I kept getting these consequences. I would catch robberies and assaults and stuff like that. So I was going to Jackson Pike, and finally I got sent to prison my first time. I think that was 2012. I was 24 years old when I went to prison the first time. I went to Ross for 2 years. But when I came home, everybody was on the Percocets.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing about those, and I'm like, well, this can't be that bad, and I'll just sell them. Then I started dabbling with them, and I met a girl, because we always meet a girl, and she really liked them. So I justified my use of them was for her. I'm only getting them because of her. Mm-hmm. That's when I got really hooked. And then she was gone. She was at work one day, and everybody's doing heroin and stuff. And I'm intrigued. I'm really intrigued by it, And even as an adolescent, I always thought about heroin for some reason, because I knew my biological parents, that was their thing, was heroin. That's what I had heard from my adopted family. So I'm watching this girl. She's shooting up, and I'm like, can I try some of that? And she tells me, you don't want none of this. And I'm like, yeah, I do. And she let me try some. And as soon as I tried it, I knew right then and there that I was fucked. But I loved it too much.
Did you smoke it, snort it, or shoot it?
I shot it the first time.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, we do it all the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I hear most people's paths, but that I've heard talk about, because, opiates is my drug of choice too. But, what I've always heard, the path is either everybody tries to, I don't know if it's justification or what, but it's, everybody starts easy, and you hear it from leads too, or people that are not surrendered yet. I wasn't shooting it yet, it's better because they're smoking it or snorting it. So that's crazy that you just fucking went
balls to the
wall. Try this out. So from there, you, no turning back.
No, once I shot dope, all bets were off right then and there. You know, you try to hide it, and I couldn't even hide it. Like day one, everybody that was driving, they knew. They might have acted like I was telling the truth and stuff, but deep down, like I could see it in their faces. They was like, "Man, this boy is on dope."
What do you mean hide it?
Like, so I overdosed the first time, and so like. My friends, so-called friends, they brought me back to my house and they just carried me in my room and left me there. So like the people that live there, and they tell them elaborate story, like, oh, he's on Xanax, he's just sleeping. And so they kind of knew. And then my baby mom got home and she waited for me to wake up, and like she was just looking at me, and you know, I told her like, oh, it's just Xanax. And she wasn't believing it. She was like, no.
Almost in respiratory failure. I'm just a couple Xanax.
Yeah.
The I have a story like that with one time that I was, you know, so high. I was on my couch and I kept like coming out from, you know, just gasping for air several times, and I was worried that I was gonna die. So like the minute that I kind of came to a little bit, I wrote down that I didn't kill myself on a post-it note. So like, I didn't want to ask for help, but I also didn't want her to find me and think I killed myself. So it's so fucked up.
Yeah.
Kind of moving on from there. So, you know, the thing that I always like to hear is, you know, what was the, like the first major desperate moment? So you know, May 2020, like what was the moment? Because you spoke up early, you know, you said prison the first time. So obviously there's a second time. What was the moment that brought you some surrender that you were able to actually get this and let it stick in May?
I'm like, you know, the prison, the insane asylums, the jails, all that, the homelessness, you know, you would think like, man, that's a lot. You know what I mean? And going through that in my mind and seeing all that stuff, it's like, man, I went through some stuff to get here and I just was not getting it. Like I kept going back, knowing intuitively that there's no way that I'm gonna make it. And but my last use, so me and a buddy, that this, because I was staying at this sober house, and it was called the Walsh House. It was actually Keystone, because this guy Mark Buttermeyer, he has Keystone and Walsh House. And so I'm over there at Keystone, and, you know, I tell him, hey, I've been using. So they was like, all right, well, you just go back to treatment. So I was supposed to go to treatment the next day. And one of the other guys in the house, he's like, hey, I heard that you've been using. You're going to treatment tomorrow. I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, you got the car. I got the money. Let's go get some. And I was like, you know, bet, you know. So we go, and, you know, I tell him to bring out two bags, you know, his and mine. He brings out one.
Mm.
And like, I'm angry and stuff, and I'm flipping out on him. And he's like, well, here, you just take it and you separate it, you know, which is any alcoholic addict's mind's like, okay, yeah, this is awesome. You know what I mean? So, you know, I jip him, and I go on about my way. And so I do some, and I put some up for the next morning to make it the detox. I remember trying to sleep, and I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, knowing that it's in that drawer. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to it. I don't know if it's going to fall over, if the roaches are going to take it, what, but it's not in my hand. So then I remember a dude downstairs, he still has some money on him. So I'm like, well, I'll just go in his pockets, take his money, do my dope, and then in the morning go to the west side and get what I need. So I go downstairs, and he's snoring. He's making this weird snoring noise. And, you know, I hit him a couple of times, like, hey, oh, you good? And, you know, he's kind of moving around and stuff. So I'm like, okay, he's good. He's not overdosing. So I go in his pocket. I take his $20. I go upstairs. I do my dope. I go to sleep. I wake up. I pack all my bags, get all my hygiene together. I'm about to go to the west side and get what I need. And when I come downstairs, I see dude, and as soon as I seen his body, I knew right then and there that he was dead. And that fucked me up, you know what I mean? Because the night before, not only did I go into his wallet, but I probably could have called the squad, and I could have saved him, you know? Maybe not, you know what I mean? But at least I could have at least tried, you know what I mean? But I let that the disease get over me and tell me something different, you know, and that hurt a lot, you know what I mean? Because I don't think I ever cared about myself, but I never wanted to hurt nobody in this process, and I feel like I did.
So was that a friend of yours?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's tough, man. So that was a moment that you had decided that you were going to try to get clean.
Yeah, that broke me.
So aside from that friend that passed away, kind of jumping around, how many other friends did you have that were close to you? Because obviously that was the catalyst that brought you to where you're at today, and you've got some time today. What did you, how many other friends have passed away that you've known and been close to?
I mean, I can't even keep track no more. I mean, there's people I grew up with, people I met in the rooms. There's a lot, but one guy in particular, I met him in sober living, and, I mean, he's seen me relapse about 3 times, and, mm-hmm. but he always was cool. And, you know, he would always like come find me and talk me into going to treatment and stuff. I mean, we were iron workers together, like the funniest dude, like a lot of people in the rooms, they know him. Like, this guy was hilarious. We would do TikToks and all types of stuff. I mean, this was my brother. Like, I don't think I've ever been this close to somebody, at least not another man. And,
what was his name?
Zach Crum.
Okay.
And my best friend. Like, I never even met his family at the time, but they knew exactly who I was just mm-hmm. because of all the stuff that we were doing and yeah. stuff. And you know, he relapsed this time during my sobriety this time, and you know, I kind of knew that he was getting high. I thought it was just smoking weed and stuff, and so I didn't really like press him about it, and I wish I would have today, you know, at least done some more. But I got the call from a buddy, and he called me. He was like, "Hey, I don't want you to find out through Facebook or nothing. I want to let you know, but they found Zach dead." I mean, it crushed me. I mean, straight crushed me. Everybody, as soon as it came out, like, I mean, my phone was ringing nonstop. Not even just AA, like iron workers, people that know me from Facebook, people that I grew up with, like, they don't even know this guy, but they know that we was tight, you know?
Just trying to make sure you're all right.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a reservation or a thought that you were going to use as a result of all that pain?
Not that. That's good. No, I don't even think I really had too many reservations with this sobriety. Like I said, I mean, I was broken mm-hmm. coming in, so I kind of know. And being around AA so long, you know, you hear everybody say, no matter what, I don't care if it's my kids, this, that, and third. So I've kind of mentally prepped myself for anything can happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The, kind of moving on to the other thing, what, says having kids or getting your kids back in recovery. Tell me why you want to talk about that.
You know, I got my son back in my life, and, he's 11. But he lives with his grandparents and his mom, and you know, his mom, like, we used to get high together and stuff. We used to do pills and stuff, and you know, she's on her own little, she doesn't do meetings or nothing like that. So I mean, I can't judge her, say what she is or whatnot. You know, I mean, I got my own opinions, but it's whatever. But I mean, luckily he has them grandparents, because them grandparents really take care of him mm-hmm. and stuff, and you know, he lives out in Hilliard. I mean, he's a good kid, plays sports, travel ball, basketball, everything, and gets good grades. But anyway, so I had been gone since he was 5. And then when I got clean, I decided I was going to get back in his life. So, you know, I took the mom to court. And, you know, in my mind, this is going to be an easy process. You know, I'm sober, this, that, and the third.
There's nothing easy about that shit.
And even though, because, you know, she's talking all this crazy stuff about me, and the judge, like, stops her and is like, I don't care about none of that. I care that he's here today. So in my mind, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is easy, you know. And but the process with him was what was so hard, like, because he didn't want to come over to my house. He doesn't want to stay the night. You know, like, when he does come over, it's probably, like, 2 hours. And then, hey, can I go home? You know, I'm like, man, like, I'm I'm clean. I'm sober. Like, I got this family I'm trying to introduce you to. I'm your, like, don't even call me dad. Calls me Charlie, you know? And, you know, instantly in my mind, I'm like, he's being coached, you know? That's neither here nor there. Even if he is, it you know, I had to look at my part of it. And, you know, I would never be in this situation. I never left and chose drugs and alcohol over him and stuff. And that's a hard pill to swallow. It was hard as a man that my child don't feel comfortable and is scared of me and stuff like that. And even with the whole court thing, like, so it finally came to, I get him one day a week for 8 hours, you know, on Sundays. And usually he plays sports on them days. So he has travel ball and basketball and stuff. So, like, realistically, I'm just going there to his games and that's it, you know. And, but that's okay today. Like, at first it wasn't, like, it hurt. Like, I mean, it was really messing with me mentally. And, you know, sometimes I'd be a dick and stuff. I'd be like, no, you can't go back home. You got to be here and stuff. And, that would just make him hate me more, you know, and I would see the anger in his face and stuff. And, so now I just kind of let him do what he wants to a point, you know, and it still kind of puts me in a situation like, well, should I be more stern with him or should I let him do him? But since I've allowed him to kind of make his own choices, like, he's gotten more comfortable with me, you know, he'll stay longer now. And he stays the actual 8, you know, and you know, because he doesn't come over every weekend. Like I said, he got sports and stuff. And then I show up to his sports events and I show up for Christmas and his birthdays and stuff like that. And I think that he's starting to see that. And, you know, he sees that because, you know, I had another kid and that's his brother, you know. And then my fiance, she has a kid, you know. And he sees these two kids and stuff and he plays with them now. And, you know, he interacts a lot more and stuff where before he was so closed off. And he's coming around now. So I got to take it slowly with him.
Yeah, that would be, you know, as a dad, I have a 12 and an 8-year-old. And that would be, it's always tough, you know, but working with the beautiful thing about a program is you work so closely with somebody else that kind of helps you get yourself out of the way. You know what I mean? Because there'd be no way initially emotionally up front that I would be able to see, like, these are the results of my consequences. Mm. Like, had that kid been with me since birth, like, this wouldn't be a conversation. So I need to let them process their time and come around. So that's tough, man. You know, and I think it's only through being clean that, you know, you're able to process it that way. But yeah, it could be an entire podcast talking about the custody situation that I went through with my baby's mom. So you talked a little bit about significant other. Obviously that was a different one, you know, cause that's the one that you're not with today, but, dealing with a significant other and, you know, you said trying the California sober. If anybody doesn't know what that is, it's usually, you know, weed and alcohol, or just weed or just alcohol, you know, that's the joke, California sober. So, you know, is she an identified, qualified alcoholic?
Yeah, so, you know, I met her in the rooms, and she identifies as an alcoholic and an addict, and she started smoking weed, and, you know, we would argue we was arguing a lot more, it seemed like, and she just kept telling me about her mental health, and you know, I'm like, well, you need to go to the doctors, blah, 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 you know, and I'm trying to assess her on my own, and she's trying to assess herself on her own, and, you know, but she tells me that she sees a doctor and stuff, it's just, like, virtual or whatever, and, but anyway, so one day I find a weed vape, and, no, instantly I'm mad, I'm hurt, and I'm angry, and all these things and stuff, because, you know, you're sneaking and hiding weed, you know, which is a drug to me, you know. And so at first, you know, I bucked against the whole thing, and I, you know, it's me or the weed, you know what I mean? And, you know, the kids are seeing us argue, and we've never fought like this. I mean, it's getting bad and stuff, and like, I had to leave one night and stuff just because of the whole situation. And, you know, I contacted some people that I'm close to, and, you know, they're like, well, you know, like, yeah, you know, you can't smoke weed, but how do you know that she can't? You know what I mean? And I'm like, okay. You know, they're like, have things been better? You know what I mean? I'm like, well, a little bit, you know what I mean? So, and it was one of them situations. I think that if it was early in recovery or before the baby was born, like I probably would have just left. You know what I mean? I'm a runner too. I've been a runner for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, let's see how things go. And, you know, I have, and truthfully, it's been better, you know, like she's in a better state of mind and stuff. Now she's pregnant again. So she stopped smoking and stuff, and which is good. So, and her mental health is pretty good. I mean, she's just pregnancy crazy, but I don't know. You know what I mean? Maybe, you know, she came into the rooms because of hard drugs and stuff. You know what I mean? So who am I to say what she can and can't do and stuff? I just kind of watch and make sure that it doesn't get too bad. And if it does, then I know what I need to do, you know? And it will be hard if I have to do something like that. It will be hard. I know it will be, but it's something that I have to do, you know what I mean? Because I believe in all my heart that, you know, I can't have that type of stuff around me or my family and stuff. But she doesn't smoke in the house. You know, she goes outside and smokes. You know, I think my disease maybe was mad at first, you know what I mean? Because, you know, I'm watching and she can do this and I can't, you know what I mean? Because I know that that's not going to be enough for me and stuff. But so we'll see. But it was definitely a trying thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm sure, you know, I haven't relapsed, but I'm sure my brain, if I was in that situation, would be wondering if my path to recovery would be the same. But I've had enough evidence for myself. Just like you said, you shot the first time. I wouldn't waste my fucking time on weed. I mean, that sounds boring. So I know I wouldn't make it long, you know, make it long at all. So. But the good thing is that the longer you continue to work a solid program, I mean, you know what it looks like. So outside of that, you know what to do, even though it would probably be really difficult if it ever got to that point.
Yeah, like she had stopped going to meetings for a while, and I was like, huh, you know, and I was noticing all that. There were signs early on, you know what I mean, that we was headed towards this. But the same, you know, when I was trying to fight her against it, it was just making her even more madder, and like I said, we was arguing a lot more. And now, just the other day, she's like, hey, I'm thinking about going to meetings again. And you know, slowly she's like, I'm not doing nothing, I'm not getting no sponsor, I'm not blah 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 blah. But I'm like, okay, God, I see you, you know what I mean? Like, maybe I just gotta sit back and observe, you know, and kind of let her find her way back into this thing.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, they talk all the time, like, you know, how powerless over your disease you are. Imagine how powerless you are for somebody else. It's like, yeah, it's fucking absolutely crazy to think that we would ever be able to do that. You talked a lot about, you know, iron worker. So leadership roles in recovery, have you accepted one? Or are you looking for one? Talk about that.
As far as like work goes, like I've been taking a lot of leadership roles. I'm pretty much on my way to forming. Like I've been running stuff. I've been running decks out here on 71 and 70, all this bridge work that you see close to downtown. Been running little stuff over here, and I've been watching God do his thing. You know, I just got back from DC a couple weeks ago. I went and got an OSHA 500. So I teach now, and like to take a picture in front of the White House is a big deal for an alcoholic addict like me. And I get to do things today. I've just met someone from the White House not too long ago. I've been on the news 3 times. You know, I teach people through this program called Building Futures. It helps people get into the union. I do that. So I took a role with that. I'm just everywhere. You know, wherever God sends me, I go to. I just got to offer. I'm about to go speak at North Central Prison here in the next week or two. And then I did a lead the other day, and I met some lady that's involved with some church. She wants me to come speak at the church. You know, I just go wherever God points me, you know.
There's nothing better than, you know, being of service in this program, especially the people that need it. And it sounds like, you know, you're doing the right thing. And those opportunities are going to present themselves. So you're interested in, you know, kind of moving forward with the leadership role.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do specifically? Steel worker?
Yeah, I'm an iron worker. Mostly a rod buster. I mean, I can weld and do structural and stuff, but I like busting rods. It just goes into the concrete and stuff. So.
Okay. And then kind of the way we'll end it, you probably had a chance to think like a war story or something. Fucking just, everybody always has so many, they can never really think about it, but something wild or crazy or a war story that's happened to you.
I've had, yeah, like you said, I've had a million, you know, just dumb stuff. Like, you know, whether it's breaking into something. I broke into a restaurant once and I was like, I'm going to break into this safe. And I took my buddy with me and, you know, we walked far and I got an AK on me, an SK on me. And I'm like, we'll just shoot the safe, you know. And so we go in there and we shoot the safe. And I mean, they're just ding, ding, ding right off of it, you know, like. Who does that in a restaurant shooting a fucking gun at a safe and thinking we're about to get rich, you know, like it's just crazy to me now. Like I would never, you know, just the type of robberies we were doing and stuff is just crazy, you know. Yeah, it was just a lot of dumb moments, a lot.
I would say that that's probably one of the dumbest moments I've heard on this podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, you thought that you were just going to shoot the lock off or something like you see in the movies.
Yeah.
On a safe.
And we still got into it, which is crazy. You know, we found some.
You just stayed there fucking firing weapons and nobody showed up?
No one. And we found Allen wrenches and like broke into it finally and got it off. And, you know, we probably got like $600 and like, you know, I got that mouth on me. Hey, I'm the best locks person in the world. You know what I mean? Like, I can hit anything. Like, it's just crazy.
Dude, I definitely appreciate your willingness to come out here, and it's going to be really cool. Like I said, we've never met, but you know, I've known your whole sobriety from having you on Facebook, and it'll be cool to watch you kind of accept those roles and grow.
Yeah. I appreciate you having me.